It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. For most people, sounds are a very important part of life. They provide us with information about our world. In some cases, they warn of us of impending danger. They allow us to communicate. They often bring us joy. But they can also be really annoying. Producer Lindsay Moon asked some IPR listeners about the sounds that drive them crazy.
I can't stand to hear a baby cry.
Holding a phone too close to your mouth and breathing into it, not realizing you're doing it, for some reason just drives me crazy.
No, sounds don't bother me. I'm a very sound-oriented person and usually think in tunes and music.
Someone trimming their toenails or fingernails, if I hear that sound, just gives me the heebie-jeebies.
I can't think of anything that really bothers me.
Yeah, the noise when you're almost going to say something but you stop. It's like like that, you know?
Yeah, dripping faucets, toilets that where water's running through them.
Honestly, it's chewing while talking on the phone. I can't handle it. It's really horrible.
Irritation is one thing, but in extreme cases, everyday sounds can trigger fear or even pain. There are a couple of different names for this response to sound. It's called misophonia or hyperacusis, and it affects 2-3% of the population. One of the people that it does affect is Matthew Mance. He lives in Fort Dodge, and he's agreed to talk with us today. Hello, Matthew.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure.
Have you always been sensitive to sounds?
Well, I think it started when I was about 8 years old. I just happened to notice one night I was sharing a room with one of my older brothers, and he came back from using the bathroom, and I heard him swallow his water. You know, he'd taken a drink, and he swallowed it right when he got back to the room. And after that, I started listening when we were eating, and my mind couldn't focus on anything else than hearing him chew and swallow and so forth. So that's about the time it was onset for myself.
How did that affect you as a kid? I mean, siblings drive a lot of people crazy, but this was much bigger than just a sibling squabble.
Right. And I was the youngest of seven kids, and so there was a big family, and no one else in my family triggered me as much as this one particular brother, and it was something about the way he chewed with kind of his mouth open and kind of slide his fork through his teeth, and then he always drank a lot of water, and I could just kind of hear the water go all the way down when he swallowed. And for some reason, it made me cringe on the inside when I heard it. And so, you know, mealtimes became very difficult, and I would actually try to sit, you know, on the other side of the table from him and away from him. And my other siblings didn't seem to trigger me as much. Occasionally, they would do things that would kind of, you know, set my teeth on edge. But mostly it was this one brother. And I remember trying to talk to him and trying to talk to my parents about it and feeling like they didn't really understand where I was coming from, and I kind of began to question my own kind of, you know, sanity or whatever, because I didn't know what was going on with me.
Right. Did this get worse with time?
In a way, yes, because, I mean, as a kid, you know, you don't have control over your environment. So suppers, family meals became a problem, any kind of holidays with food became a problem, and I remember fighting to try to just have meals in my own room just to get away from it, and occasionally I was able to do that, but I really had to, you know, throw a big fit. But over time, some other triggers developed. My dad would actually kind of slurp his coffee in his soup, and that was something that I just couldn't be around. And this one brother that I'm talking about, when he would eat cereal, I had to, you know, practically be on a different level of the house than where he was. And and another big trigger for me was just sniffing, and sometimes when my mom would sniff, that would bother me. And then other people, like kids at school during a test or something, I wouldn't be able to concentrate on the test because I would zero in on the sniffing in such a way that I was almost like paralyzed in sense that I couldn't focus or train my brain on anything else at that particular time.
When did you actually discover that this was a disorder, not just a personality quirk?
Well, I'm 46 now, and it was probably 5 or 6 years ago. And
wow.
So this is relatively recent for me, and it was just kind of mind-blowing to realize that other people had this same kind of condition going on. I mean, it was really transformational for me. And that's the same thing I've heard from other people, that when they discovered a name for it, it really was a huge relief.
So now that you know it's a disorder and you have a little more understanding of what sounds actually do to you, can you describe for me what's happening in your body when you hear one of these sounds that's a trigger for you?
Well, now I'm married, and my wife Anne and I have four kids, and what I've discovered is that sometimes my kids are triggers for me. And so, again, back to the sniffing thing, kids sniff. I mean, it's just a natural part of life. But when I hear them sniff, they know me well enough. My oldest, you know, is 13 now. They know me well enough. I'm going to hand them a Kleenex, and I'm going to just kind of be on them until they blow their nose or literally stop sniffing in my presence, because there's something about, it's almost like I feel something in the back of my neck, kind of almost like I can't control my response. Like if they were to keep sniffing in front of me, I would just literally kind of try to climb the wall and try to just, you know, escape the situation, because it just kind of makes, you know, my insides just kind of cringe, and it really kind of triggers this fight, flight, or freeze response. I mean, and they've shown through studies that the adrenaline actually starts pumping in those of us that have this when we hear these certain trigger sounds. And so it is often, unfortunately, it's often those people that we're around the most that trigger us, and I'm not sure why that is. So it is often family members that are our biggest triggers.
So it's really almost as if you're being put in danger by these sounds.
Yes, and there's some, there's some theories about maybe it's some evolutionary trait that, you know, we needed to be aware of certain sounds when we were living, you know, as cavemen and cavewomen, and we needed to kind of have this extrasensory perception about us that has kind of, you know, stayed with us. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, it makes a little sense that if we hear kind of a twig cracking in the distance, that we might want to know what's causing that. And so some of us are kind of hypersensitive to that sound, and it's not pleasant. I mean, I wouldn't wish this on anyone. You know, when I am able to get myself out of a situation that's triggering me, I'm exhausted. I mean, I feel like, again, like an adrenaline rush has happened, and I just need to kind of decompress a little.
Now, when you were a kid, obviously you had very little control over your environment. As you got older, did you find that you tried to really arrange your life to protect you from sound?
Right. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I think I did. I think it became such a part of who I am. I mean, I'm kind of a quiet person, and I tend to be kind of self-isolating in general. And I think in college, I just kind of isolated around. I would avoid people that I think, you know, where I discovered were my triggers, and I would just kind of physically avoid them. And that's what I hear from other misophones, that they do the same thing and have done the same thing. And now I'm a therapist with Lutheran Services in Iowa, and so I meet one-on-one with people, and I often, you know, I can control that environment for the most part. I mean, it's not like I'm in an office setting with cubicles and so forth, but over time I have noticed that I try to just as much as I can control my environment, and I think probably dating was kind of an issue when I think I was kind of singling people out when, if I was going on a date and I didn't like something that the girl did, I would probably in my mind kind of check, you know, mark her off my list, so to speak, and she would never know why. And I'm sure this was for me kind of a subconscious thing that I was doing without even kind of realizing it on some level.
So, of course, you did get married. You have four kids,
yep,
which puts you in a situation where you can't control a lot about your environment.
Right.
How do you cope with it on a day-to-day basis? Like, do you carry earplugs with you?
Well, I don't, although some people do. I mean, I sleep with earplugs just because it helps me sleep better. I mean, I am pretty sensitive to sounds. I mean, my wife has known that about me ever since we started going out. But, I mean, I remember the night we got engaged, I actually kind of had a little heart-to-heart with my wife. And, you know, we just had this wonderful romantically inclined engagement. We were at Disneyland, and we were sitting in the car, and I said, listen, I've got to tell you, I've got this thing, you know, and I didn't have a name for it. And I said, you know, I'm sensitive to sniffing. And she was very gracious and very, you know, kind of sensitive to my needs. But and she has, you know, kind of made necessary adjustments so that she's not a trigger for me. But I also, I mean, it's just kind of a sensitive thing. It's not something you bring up to just anyone, you know, in casual conversation. But I noticed online there are a lot of helpful, you know, support groups for people that have this condition, and it's just I feel better for the kids that have this now that know that they have support and resources that they can turn to.
Well, and you said it was a life-changing thing to discover that this is a disorder and that you're not alone. How has it changed your life?
Well, it just made me realize that, you know, what I experienced was real. And I think what it did is kind of made me, over the years, made me more sensitive having this condition because I was sensitive to the plight of others, whether they were, you know, had mental health conditions or other. I mean, I think I'm just kind of a sensitive person. And I recently went to a Misophonia Association convention out in Las Vegas. And it's kind of what it would sound like, a bunch of people that are sensitive to sound getting together. And there were no drinks or food allowed in the meeting hall. And there was no gum chewing allowed. That's another big trigger for folks. And I kind of got the sense that we were all kind of kindred spirits, those of us that have this condition, that we have this kind of sensitivity to others that I don't know if it's, you know, because we have the condition or as a result, or I'm not sure how that's related, but I got this sense that we are very tuned in to the plight of other people because we know what it's like to have this kind of trigger situation going on when we're out. It really just feels like you're out of control, and it's just a terrible, terrible feeling.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today.
Sure.
Matthew Mance lives in Fort Dodge. He suffers from misophonia, this extreme sensitivity to sound. And we'll talk more about this disorder in a moment. You are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. 8 o'clock. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about extreme sensitivity to sound. Some people call it misophonia. Others call it hyperacusis. Either way, for people who suffer from it, it can be difficult. It can range to devastating. Everyday sounds can trigger fear, anger, or even pain. And I want to introduce a couple of people who study sensitivity to sound. Richard Tyler is an audiologist and the director of the Audiology Division at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Hello, Richard.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Philip Gander is also with us. He's an associate research scientist in the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Iowa and recently published a paper on this condition. Hello, Philip.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. And Rich, I want to start with you. You don't like the term misophonia because misophonia means the dislike of sounds. You feel like this condition goes a lot farther than that. So describe for me what you're talking about exactly.
Well, I think it's helpful for the public and for other professionals not involved in this to appreciate the kinds of symptoms that people have. And the term hyperacusis has been around for 50 or 60 years, hyper-excessive acoustics sound, so some excessive response to sound. So that should be clear. And then the kind of symptoms that people experience from this, I and others have categorized this in four different ways. So some people experience sounds that are moderately loud as very loud. We refer to that as loudness hyperacusis. Some people experience sounds that are not very loud, but they're just annoyed by them. And your introductory speaker gave some examples of that. We refer to that as annoyance hyperacusis. Some people actually change their lifestyle and refuse to go to events like cafeterias or basketball games because they're afraid of the sounds that might be there. And we refer to that symptom as fear hyperacusis. And there are some people who actually experience real pain from the sounds, and we refer to that as pain hyperacusis. So that's the way that we and others like to categorize this.
So I think, as we mentioned earlier, a lot of us are bothered by some sounds, but there's a line that some people go past, that they cross, where the sounds are not just annoying, but is it that they actually interfere with their day-to-day life? Is that when we know this is something more than typical annoyance?
Yeah, I guess that's one way of thinking about it. I guess everybody can be bothered by a chalk on a chalkboard, but I don't think that's the same thing. I think we're talking about here some excessive response in the brain that's not normal, that not everybody experiences. Fortunately, only a few people do, and it can lead to real challenges in life, as we outlined.
Phil, I know that you recently published a paper on this condition. What was it that made you want to go farther to research this condition?
So our lab and researchers in the group are interested in understanding sort of the interface of sound and cognition or thinking, and what is it that makes auditory objects, as we call them. So what makes my speech a thing that you understand? And one of the important factors related to this is not only whether or not we're listening to sounds or how tired we are or what memories we have related to certain sounds, but also our general emotional reaction to certain sounds. And so what we've just been talking about is a good example of perhaps abnormal emotional reactions to particular sets of sounds or different types of sounds. And so that's how we kind of got started in the research.
Okay, so looking at how that's actually working in the body, what were you able to discover about what's going on inside the brain of somebody who has this condition?
Right, so we reached out to a number of people, actually in the UK, and my research colleagues in the UK were able to get people who had self-identified as having misophonia or an extreme reaction to sound, and we brought them into the lab and basically played different sounds to them. So some normal sounds like footsteps or rain or some things like this, just sort of neutral sounds that wouldn't really evoke any reaction in someone. And then some generically annoying sounds that we would all consider annoying, like a baby crying or nails on a chalkboard or things like this. And then a particular set of what the caller also referred to as trigger sounds. So sounds that really set this strong emotional reaction in someone, this fight or flight response that he described very well. And what we found is when we used a group of people who identified as having misophonia, and then also a group of people who were, quote, normal or didn't experience those reactions, we looked at their brain response across these different categories of sounds, and we found that they didn't differ in terms of the reaction to the neutral and the annoying sounds, but they very much differed quite considerably in response to these trigger sounds. And specifically, the misophonia group had a very abnormally large reaction in a part of their brain that's related to sort of self-monitoring of internal body states. And this is a part of the brain called the anterior insula.
All right, and what does that mean, do you think?
So what we think is basically that this is representing basically straightforward, just an overreaction that these people experience to this particular set of sound in terms of how they are monitoring their bodily state and how they are reacting to it. And so we also looked at how this anterior insula brain region was connected to other brain regions. And we found areas also connected to things that are responsible for emotional processing, not surprisingly, but also attention and memory. And one of the key other brain areas was in the frontal area of the brain, in particular a complicatedly named place, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And this brain region is known to have sort of an executive control or control response for overseeing how we react to things. This seems like it makes a lot of sense that really what seems to be happening is the circuitry, the communication between areas of the brain that are controlling our response to our body, and the area of the brain that is responding to internal states of the body is abnormal. And this is what we found in the group of people who had misophonia, and specifically only for these types of sounds.
All right. So just as we were talking about earlier with Matthew, it's kind of that fight or flight reaction. The body is responding to sound as if it is in physical danger.
Exactly. And so another thing that we have as good evidence, he didn't mention it, but I bet he might not be surprised or agree with that this might be a type of response he gets when you ask him, is that we also measured in these people their skin conductance response, or commonly called the galvanic skin response. And this is just like a sweating response that you can place on the palm. And so we all sort of sweat under conditions of stress. And this was something that we measured in the misophonia group, and this was also very strongly triggered specifically for these misophonia or trigger sounds, that they had a greater sort of stress response.
So we
a clear example of the operation of this fight or flight system.
So we know more about how this is affecting someone's body. Does this give us ideas on how we could help people with this disorder, or does it just raise more questions at this point?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And what we're really hoping is that this lays the foundation for really reasonable, concrete evidence for what we use the term phenotype. So what is it that is the example of the expression of this in the body? Of this disorder, it really is a real thing that's going on differently in the bodies and the brains of these people, and it provides a target for treatment, a clear target. Going forward, that's what we'd like to try and do.
We're talking about extreme sensitivity to sound. Some people call it misophonia, others call it hyperacusis. And we'd love to hear from you this hour. We have a lot of people who want to join this conversation at 866-780-9100. With me, Richard Tyler, an audiologist and the director of the Audiology Division at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Philip Gander, associate research scientist in the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Iowa, and Kim is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Thank you so much for calling. And this is something you've had to deal with in your life. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I can. And first, I just want to thank you for having this segment and having these guests, because knowing that this is real and having other people hear that is a breath of fresh air and an ounce of relief. I've had this since at least the beginning of elementary school, and it's been debilitating and increasingly so as I grow older, and I'm now in my mid to late 30s. I've never been able to have family dinners. I've never been able to do that without just panicking or slamming a fist on the table and having to get out of there. I can't tell you the last time I've been to the movies. The mere thought of that is terrifying to me. One of the things that's been so hard for me is I'm a very social person. I love being around people. My career focuses on being around people, but it's really a disorder that you can't accommodate, and I haven't found a way to do that despite every headphone and white noise and all of that. It's just you have to work so much harder just to get by in the day, let alone get your work done and be pleasant around people. I mean, I have panic attacks at least two or three a week, and I'm just constantly exhausted and physically, mentally, and emotionally drained. And it's also just been a really isolating disorder. I mean, there's certain family members that I've fallen out of touch with because of the trigger sounds, and they believe that this is me, you know, not liking them and finding ways to pick on them when it has nothing to do with whether I like them or not. Some of the trigger sounds are made by people I care deeply about. It's caused some friendships to suffer. And ultimately, I would say it was a large factor in my divorce, because living with misophonia and sharing a home with somebody was extremely hard. And I know it took a huge toll on my then husband and myself. So I'm just grateful that you're having this segment, and you know, the misophonia is hard enough, but one of the hardest parts too is the depression and anxiety that comes from it as well. The feeling that you're alone and people don't understand, and the feeling of hopelessness.
Well, and Kim, it sounds like with a lot of people in your life not understanding that it's a disorder has also led them to think very differently about you, to cast your personality in a completely different light.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so having a name for it has helped some. Of course, it's been a challenge. You know, when I talk about it, people say, oh, I think I have that too. You know, I get really annoyed at this. And it's constantly having to educate people that this is not just a pet peeve. This is a debilitating, life-altering disorder that affects so many aspects of our lives, and it's a 24/7 thing. You know, and also I can even think back to middle and high school and college, and now my work as a professional, you have to work 10 times harder just to cope and then get your work done. I mean, I often fantasize, like, what would my life be like if I didn't have this? I would be so much more productive, so much more successful, and not feeling this constant state of panic and fear and anxiety. So,
well, Kim, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today. And Rich, I'd love to get your reaction to what Kim was saying. I mean, I think that this is the kind of thing, as Kim was just saying, where when she describes it to people, people think, oh, yeah, I think sounds are gross, too. But Kim throws this into to really clear relief that it's so much more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the same as just being bothered by a chalkboard. This is has a major impact in lots of people and in different ways. And you know, her example is not her example she gave is not uncommon. We see all kinds of patients, just like Kim, that have very similar descriptions of the kinds of sounds that are annoying that have disrupted their lives.
How common do you think this is?
Well, it's difficult to know. It's difficult to ask questions and do a survey on this, but I think it's estimated to be anywhere between 1 and 3 to 5% of the population.
So that means it's affecting a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like it's being recognized more frequently now? People are getting help now?
Yeah, I'm actually glad to say that, I should also mention this often occurs with tinnitus, ringing in the ears. Not always, but often it occurs, and often occurs with hearing loss. And I'm glad to say that maybe in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a lot more clinicians interested in learning more about helping patients with tinnitus and with hyperacusis, getting appropriate training, and opening up clinics around the country to try and help people with hyperacusis in this case.
Now, listening to Kim, talking to Matthew earlier, both of them had this develop as they were children. Is that common?
It's not uncommon. I think it's probably more common for this to happen as an adult. Some of the more common causes are, for example, noise exposure, often musicians. It could also be a head injury. It could be a single explosion, like a gun going off close to your head, or fireworks even. So there's also different kinds of etiologies that are associated with this same hyperacusis symptoms, including things like autism and multiple sclerosis, some diseases like Meniere's syndromes.
So you mentioned that for many people this might be something that comes on in adulthood. Is it also related to hearing loss or the change in someone's hearing?
Well, it certainly has to be related to hearing, since it's a symptom related to the hearing system. It doesn't always occur with a significant hearing loss, but I'm going to say it almost always does. So most of the patients we see have a hearing loss with their hyperacusis. And as I also said, probably about 60 or 70% of the patients who come forth with hyperacusis also have ringing in their ears.
It seems counterintuitive that hearing loss would also result in this sensitivity to sound. Why do you think there might be a connection?
Well, it's not exactly known, but a hearing loss obviously is a malfunction of the auditory system in some ways, and some people might, and the analogy we sometimes use is that, you know, if when you lose lose some hearing, you lose some nerve fibers that go up to the brain that transfer information about hearing, and maybe the brain, as Phil mentioned, does some reorganization and changes. And one analogy is that the brain kind of holds up a magnifying glass to try and make up for the loss of nerve fibers and loss of information. And that magnifying glass tends to magnify and amplify some of the sounds.
Interesting. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Richard Tyler, an audiologist and director of the Audiology Division at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and Philip Gander, also at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about extreme sensitivity to sound. There are a couple of names for it. Misophonia is one that we've been hearing a lot of in articles and studies that have been released in recent months and years. Hyperacusis is another term for it, but it can be devastating for people who suffer from it. Everyday sounds can trigger fear, anger, or even pain. With me this hour, Richard Tyler, an audiologist and the director of the Audiology Division at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Philip Gander is here, an associate research scientist at the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Iowa. He recently published a paper on misophonia. And I want to get to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Charles is on the line next in Indianola. Hello, Charles.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for calling.
Yes, you're welcome. I would like the experts to address a problem of a sound that a person can't get away from, and that's tinnitus. It's a little different field, I'm sure, than what they're describing, but it's also, I call it an affliction. I've had tinnitus since 1965. It's constant, and if I think about it, I suppose it would drive me nuts, but it's like the dog, if it stopped, it would be like the dog that doesn't bark, if you understand what I'm trying to say. I'd like to have them at least comment on that problem.
Absolutely. And so what you hear in your ears, Charles, is a kind of a high-pitched squeal?
Yes, that's exactly right, and it's really powerful. And loud noises, or of any kind, will set it off and make it a little more extreme for me.
All right. And
so consequently, I've tried to avoid as much as I can any sudden noise. And the one caller that mentioned movies, if I go to movies, I almost have to wear earplugs, to, especially when they have preview upcoming movies, because the sound is so loud.
All right. And Richard, you did mention earlier tinnitus or tinnitus as something that is related to hyperacusis. Tell me more about that.
So it's at least related in some people. So again, about 30% of the people who have hyperacusis also have tinnitus, or maybe 50 or 60%. It's, again, hard to know. There's possibly some similar mechanisms. At some level, it's important to appreciate that the treatment, some people can actually be helped, with hyperacusis and with tinnitus. And it turns out that the treatment, at least one of the treatments, is quite similar, and that is usually a low-level background sound. And having a low-level background sound playing in the background, and there are lots of wearable devices by many companies these days to do this appropriately, and as I said, many clinicians are now trained and involved in this. What it's actually doing potentially is, you know, I mentioned that one of the theories is this magnifying glass, so the brain's kind of turning up the activity, maybe turning it up too much, and searching for this activity that it really shouldn't be. And by having a low-level background sound and wearing wearable devices that present this low-level background sounds for long periods of time and forgetting them and ignoring them actually provides that information to the brain, and the brain no longer has to turn things up. And therefore, eventually, it might take a few months, but eventually for some people, they're actually their tinnitus becomes less prominent, and their hyperacusis decreases in severity. So I think that there are some similarities between tinnitus and hyperacusis, both in the mechanisms and in the treatments.
Well, and Charles, you mentioned you've been suffering from this since 1965. What kinds of treatments have you had to help you deal with it?
I talked to doctors about audiologists, and no one, this is the first time I'm hearing about this background noise or substituting something. And so they usually give me the statement that I just have to learn to live with it. There's not much they can do. Mine was caused by carelessness. I was target practicing with a pistol and didn't wear any hearing protection, which was extremely stupid on my part. And so I'm paying for it.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience. And Rich, are treatments changing a lot? I mean, it sounds like Charles hasn't really gotten much out of going to doctors to talk about this.
Well, at this point, there is no pill for tinnitus or hyperacusis in most situations, although, again, we're talking generally here, and there are, you know, different causes, as I mentioned, for these sorts of things. But in general, there is no pill or surgery that anybody can offer you with any degree of certainty to make your hyperacusis or tinnitus go away. Having said that, there are lots of things that many people find helpful, including some counseling. One that we offer we call hyperacusis activities treatment that we've developed over many, many years, and also the use of low-level sounds. And I could point out that 10 years ago, there were three or four companies developing these wearable devices, and now there are probably 20 companies developing these devices and selling them. And the reason for that is because people are purchasing them because they find them helpful. Doesn't work for everybody. It can take several months, but since the focus is on hyperacusis today, I'll focus on that. Just using these low-level sounds in the background and getting on with your life is one approach. Another approach is to listen to background noise in the evening, where you are under control of the background noise. You're under control over the level and the duration, and you can increase that over time. And then the third treatment that we devised many years ago is some people, as has been mentioned initially, have annoyance and fear and pain from very specific sounds. So we actually record sounds like this or have the patients record these sounds and then again listen to the sounds themselves when they're comfortable, when they're sitting on a couch in their living room, at a level they can control and for a duration that they're comfortable with. And then eventually over several weeks and over several months, increase the level, increase the duration. If it's dishes clanging together, move to the kitchen eventually, and eventually clang some of those dishes yourself and take control over that. So we call this successive approximations to the actual real sounds that people are annoyed by. And again, it doesn't work for everybody, but for a lot of people, there are things that can be done to help tinnitus and hyperacusis.
Phil, is there anything you'd like to add? I mean, now that we're understanding more about how this is working in the body, does that also give us some ideas on treatment?
And I think it's important to note the link with what Rich said about trying to gain control, perhaps, over hearing these sounds, in particular ones that are going to induce these fight-or-flight responses, and the finding that we had related to abnormal activity in an area of the brain that does have some control over how we experience our world. And it may indeed be the fact that this type of a treatment approach really needs to change this activity that occurs in this frontal area of the brain. One thing that I should definitely note that we did look for in the brains of these people, we looked at activity in the brain, but we also looked at the anatomical structure of the brain. And in particular, we looked at the different regions of the brain that we had found related to this abnormal reaction for the trigger sounds in the misophonia group. And we found that in the frontal area of the brain, they had an increase in the myelin, or basically the wrapping around the neurons in the brain, that was abnormally large as compared to what it was in the control group. And what we really think this is an example of how the neural circuitry has actually changed in these people in terms of what supports how their brain functions. And it's difficult then to know if this is something that they were born with or if this is something that developed over time. But it is an attractive idea that perhaps it is something that learned over time, as some of the callers have already mentioned, that this is something they started being affected with at a relatively young age. And so what it means is, in terms of treatment, we have a brain area and a certain type of approach that might be able to tap into this knowledge.
Let's go back to the phones. Melody is on the line in Dexter. Hi, Melody.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what would you like to talk about?
You've talked a little bit about the treatment options. I have a daughter who's 6 years old, and she gets visibly upset, sometimes physically upset, by just hearing people chew at the dinner table or hearing me chew gum. I at first felt bad, like one of the callers talked about this negatively impacting her family relationships, and I can see that because I would get, you know, annoyed at my daughter for me doing something that was just a normal part of my life. But in thinking about it, my brother had something similar, and he stopped being able to eat really dinner around us at all. So he was able to talk to my daughter about his feeling, which I think was helpful. And now we're able to talk about it together that, you know, she'll say this isn't something that I can necessarily control her feeling about it, but we're trying to talk about how she can control her reaction. You talked a little bit about some of the therapies that might be available. Are these therapies that could be available to children? And is it something that I could do with her that I would need to see a professional? And then is there any thoughts about on this being genetic or running in one's family?
Rich, do you want to tackle that?
Yes. So, it's important to appreciate that there are different causes and different subgroups. We talk about hyperacusis as if it's one thing, but it's different manifestations and different causes and different effects on the brain in different people. The treatments that I mentioned are also applicable to children. It's sometimes a little more complicated, but again, it's important to get the children involved in things and to see what goes on, and important to have some control. And, you know, for example, sometimes it's important to have the child make the sounds themselves, or to have one of their friends make the sounds, or to see someone else make the sounds. And it can also depend on, for example, if the child is actually in control of making the sounds, then it sometimes gives them an opportunity to accustom and habituate to it. Whereas if somebody else is doing the sound, they don't have any control over it whatsoever. So it's different in different people, but there are some strategies that can be used both for children and for adults.
Anything you'd like to follow up on, Melody?
What about it being connected? I have a dad who has that ringing in his ears, and he's lost his hearing almost fully. And then my brother also having this strong reaction to sound. Is there any connection to family members having that?
Well, certainly that can be true for hearing loss, and it certainly can be true for tinnitus, but not completely clear. I think because of the many, many different causes of our hyperacusis and many different mechanisms involved, there's probably a greater chance for some a genetic underlying factor involved, but it's really hard to know.
Well, and Phil, as I mentioned earlier, your new research kind of opens up a whole box of new questions. That has to be one of the questions that people are looking at.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And as Rich said, that we, unfortunately, at this point, in terms of genetic causes, it's unclear. But it's definitely something worth looking into, and whether or not there's at least the sort of classic idea of a predisposition to having a certain abnormal reaction to a sound, or having that be started as a result of hearing loss or some other event in someone's life. It's difficult to know at this stage. I think as Rich also mentioned, it's what's really nice is that this is now really just beginning to start to be recognized as something that should be researched and can be researched. And I think that it's good we're moving forward.
Jason is on the line in Marshalltown. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Gosh, you guys all covered pretty much everything I was asking. I've been, for 13 years, I've been dealing with this with my wife. I mean, even chewing, I can't. I've had a injury on my jaw, so when I chew and eat, it even gets emotional reactions to her. And this is a great justification for people who have this condition because nobody believes them. Or like the lady who called, even family situations where people think you're mad at them or you're not a nice person because you have this condition and nobody understands it. And I'm just glad to see that it's going and there are some treatments. That was great to hear about these treatments. I'm going to look into that. Is there a website or any place where a person can go get more information?
Well, and Rich, where do you look for more information if this is something that you are either living with or wondering if you might be living with?
So there is a Hyperacusis Association and that has a website. There is also the American Tinnitus Association that is now broadening its scope to include hyperacusis. We actually at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics are having our 25th annual international conference on tinnitus and hyperacusis this June, and we welcome patients. It's mostly for professionals, but we usually have a handful of patients show up as well. And of course, we have a clinic, tinnitus and hyperacusis clinic, in the hospital as well. So there's lots of ways to get useful resources.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Jason. And we're nearly out of time, but as we've talked about this hour, clearly this is a disorder that is getting more attention now. It's becoming more recognized now. For people who suspect that someone in their life may have a hypersensitivity to sound or maybe they themselves do, what's the first step, Rich?
Well, I would say the first step is to have a hearing evaluation. You can go to your family practitioner and see what they have to say. They might not be helpful, but if you see an audiologist or if you see an otolaryngologist, they would be able to try and rule out other disease processes that might be relevant that could be treated first or that could be related to the hyperacusis. But eventually, as I said, usually the audiologists are the ones that are involved in providing the treatments. There is something that can be done, and I think it's important to appreciate that.
And as awareness grows, hopefully tolerance will grow as well for people who live with those who suffer from this disorder. Rich Tyler, thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Richard Tyler is an audiologist and the director of the Audiology Division at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Philip Gander, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Philip Gander is an associate research scientist in the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Iowa.